the highest, demonstrates that they're not allowing, the translator is not allowing their preconceived concepts to overtly influence how they translate a word. Which is super important, really. I know from reading the Bible. Next would be Marshall's dialogue and Concordant dialogue. Then the Kingdom Interlinear dialogue, believe it or not. Douglas dialogue, Wilson dialogue, that's our Benjamin Wilson, the one we use a lot. Then there's Panin, Bowers, Woos, and then Wayman is rated high. So in comparison, Wayman is at 71 overall, whereas Rotherham's is 85 overall. That's kind of a... Then you have Schoenfield, Ballantyne, Today's English Version, Anchor Bible, Moffat, Kingsley, Charles William, Horner, which is a Coptic. The New Revised Standard Version is down to 62% overall. Smith, Goodsey, Byington, the NIV is down to 62% overall. And it just goes on. He's got, I didn't number them here, but it looks like about 50 or 60. So, he did the same in the Old Testament. Got the same appendix in the Old Testament. And the one that's really good, again, is, no surprise, it's Rotherham's. It's really good. But, as you all know, you got to read, like, I call it the Yoda Bible, because it's an emphasize, which means that the verses are reconstructed for the emphasis that the writer intended, which is not the way we read English quite often, because it's another language that they're translating. But they're translating it with the emphasis that the writer had. So sometimes it reads funny. So it's not my everyday Bible, but it's certainly one that we want to use as a reference if we're looking for one of those that we're going to check the understanding. But I got to say, the NIV in the Old Testament is very readable. Even though it doesn't rate high on accuracy, it's very readable. This is at Nestle's Marshall Interlinear that was mentioned as being quite accurate. It's just like the dialogue, except without the footnotes that are helpful. But if you're witnessing to somebody, this is a good one to use because the dialogue, Benjamin Wilson, when Brother Russell died, when Judge Rutherford took over the watchtower, he got the rights to the Benjamin Wilson dialogue that Brother Russell had previously bought him. And so they had a printing plate. So they were printing Wilson's dialogue, which is the watchtower name in the front page. So when you're witnessing to people, if they're being very critical, they say, well, that's a watchtower publication. You're J.W. So they got enough. You go to that spiel I just did, and they're kind of like still on that. So Eusis gives you the same exact place. The concordant, someone likes to emphasize the dunce on the end, the concordant text, which rated very high. The benefit of this is that it uses the Sinaitic, the Vatican 1209 manuscript, which is the better, and the Alexandrian manuscript. And what they do is on every word or verse, if there is a difference in one of those three, which I consider the three oldest, if there is a difference, they tell you in the script above it, saying the Sinaitic omits this word, or these words, or the Alexandrian omits those words. So you can consider whether or not something is omitted or changed in the three oldest best manuscripts. So this is helpful in that way. But it too reads like Yoda speak. Because, as you see, there's no break in the Greek. Because the Greek didn't have those kind of breaks. It was written like what we would call like uppercase. And when we were just in the British Museum, we looked at the Sinaitic manuscript laying open, and that's exactly what it was. Just no breaks, no periods, no dots, no dashes, no separations. So our time is up. Let's take it one more second to demonstrate old school. I'll show you old school. I'll do it real quick. This is an interlinear Greek-English New Testament. But it has a double blessing. Each word has Strong's number above it. So I'm going to take the word, I'm going to turn tree, the word presence. And of course, it has the word come here in this. But it gives you the Greek word written out above it, and it gives you Strong's number. It's 3952. 3952. And in the back of this book, it has Strong's Concordance. So you can turn right then and there and look up your number. And you can read Strong's definition. Now, under the word coming, as we saw there in the King James, it has, when you look it up in Strong's, his first interpretation is presence. His second is coming. But presence is first, not coming. So that automatically makes you start to wonder. So there's that resource. And then you say to yourself, well, I wonder how else it's used in the New Testament, that word presence, or that Greek word. And that's where you go to Englishman's Greek Concordance. And blessedly for me, this one too is corded to Strong's. That's why I bought it. So I don't have to learn the Greek. I can just turn to my number, which was 39, did I say? I expect you to remember. 39? 52. 39, 52. And it has the Greek word written in Greek letters, the English pronunciation, parousia or parousia, depending on how you like to say that. And then there's every verse in the New Testament where that word appears in the King James. And it tells you in English what that word was. So you read down in here, and you're going along, you're saying, coming, 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 presence. Oh. 2 Corinthians 10:10 says, but his bodily presence is weak. Well, how come it doesn't say coming like all these others? It's because he wasn't coming, he was present. And so this is telling you how that word is translated in the King James. But it's the one Greek word. That's excellent on studying the word hell and this, that, and the other. So there's that resource. And it's quoted to Strong, so it goes fast. So then, if you say, okay, I've got Strong's understanding, I see where it's used in everywhere in the New Testament, I go to Thayer's English Lexicon. I'm going to a lexicon. I've left the concordance, I've left the dictionary, I'm going to a lexicon. This is Thayer's, and it's coded to Strong's. I'm going, oh, that's great. Another shortcut. So I turn to my number, 30...
52.
You say, oh, gosh. How does he find his way through all that? 39:52, and 1st use of the word, number one, presence. 2nd use, the presence of one coming. The presence of one coming. So the first and second interpretation is presence. So now you've got that from the lexicon. And there's multiple lexicons. Then you say, well, you know what? Maybe they got it all wrong. Well, then you go to Liddell and Scott. Now, Liddell and Scott is a Greek-English lexicon, but it's not on the Bible. It's all Greek literature. They'll quote scriptures if it's relevant, but that's not their primary resource. They're going through Homer's Odyssey and blah, 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 whatever the Iliad, any ancient Greek writer. And that's what this is for. So who uses this besides bookstop, not doorstop? College students, professors, undergraduates on studies that are researching papers in ancient languages. If theirs is Greek, this will be their source material. Now, of course, now it's probably online and you don't have to comfort with it. However, this is so Greek, everything in it is so Greek until you read it, that I had to write my cheat sheet of my Greek alphabet at the beginning. So I could look at that letter and then thumb through and say, oh, I'm getting close, because I don't know the Greek alphabet. But I didn't need to. That's not how to write it down. So when I look under presence, Which, by the way, I wrote down as page 1,343. Got a little smarter there. 1,343. The last time I used this is my page in here. It's from looking up Bazanizo's fortune.
Yeah.
It means to strike a gold or silver on a basalt stone. To test it, if it's true or not. It's true gold, true silver. There is an end game to this. Okay. I'm under presence. I'm seeing the Greek word. I see the English first definition, presence. Not persons. First definition. And it goes into all this great detail that I won't bore you with, but half I don't understand because it's in Greek, but I get down to the number two, which I do understand, and it's arrival. So, okay, I keep skipping down. I get to number three is occasion. Number four is entertain them on their official visits. Number five, the advent. Number six, situational, and so on and so on. The first two, though, are presence or arrival. So then I say, okay, that's great. And then I start looking at all my Bible translations on Matthew 24:3. I'm looking through all my translations, and guess what? The majority of them still say coming. Why do they still say coming? So you say, well, it's not because of dictionary. It's not because of concordance. It's not because of the lexicon. It's not because of other Greek, ancient Greek writing. Then what is it? Why don't the majority have presence? There's only one answer. Satan's blinded the minds. And their prejudice, their doctrinal prejudice, keeps them from translating it correctly. So, but we do have like about 11 translations that all have presence, either in the text or as a footnote. And they're better because they did that. American Standard, 1901, the Concordant Greek Text, which we looked at, the emphasized emphatic diet. If you want this list, I'm happy to give that. The emphatic dialogue that we use for our Fenton, the four Gospels of Revelation by Latimer, the Interlinear Greek English Bible by Green, the Jerusalem Bible, Moffat, New Testament from the Greek text, established by Bible Numerics, Revised New Testament, Unvarnished New Testament, Weymouth, thank goodness, Word Study Greek New Testament, Young's Literal Translation of the Bible, and you end up with about 10 or 11. But that's it. I have 60 translations in my library at home. I looked at every one. I can only come up with about 11. Sister?
Yeah, I just wanted to, since we to make a motion that we allow you to study.
I'll go into another topic.
Whatever you want to do.
Okay. Is there a second for the motion? Chris, second?
Can you finish this?
Sure. Probably a smart thing to do. Alright. Bardane, you want to call for a vote on the motion?
All in favor of Brother Rick continuing in the next hour, please indicate. Lots of votes. Everyone except for two, and it's any against going on the second hour? Nobody. So
careful. Right. That makes no offense if it didn't. So, then we'll just close there. I'll just double back on this. Thank you for your time. And let's just use the choice of one hymn to close, a verse of the hymn to close with. Probably pretty straightforward. It's methodology more than anything. That being said, Barbara?
You don't have to answer it now. Maybe like during the testimony meet or sometime in the future. But what was the first subject that you studied when you became a Christian? I guess that would be interesting.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. That's nice. It was super early on a Saturday morning, or Sunday morning, probably. Sunday morning, it works 6 days a week. Sunday morning, I was living with four other guys. in a rented house at the corner. We were on Rochester Road, just north of Waddle, 17 miles. So we were in Troy back in the day, playing back in Troy. We rented 5 acres of this sprawling 1950s ranch house that had like a four-car garage attached to it. And the guy was selling the property to be developed. So if you went there today, you'd see a whole subdivision in there, mini subdivision in there. And a bank. None of that was there then. So we bought it, So five total of us were running it. One of the other renters was Brother Brad Bach, who was from here, was living out in California now. He and Sister Marilyn consecrated after that. And I was living there. And you ever see O'Sullivan Moving Trucks? That's Michael Sullivan. He was living there. And he started that. And Norm Pedler's older brother, who was murdered, Bruce Pedler, was living there. And something we all had in common was we all had motorcycles. And so I'm in the garage, and I'm trying to lift this engine into my 1960 Harley Panhead, and trying to line up the bolts. And lo and behold, Norm Pedler came to see his brother Bruce. It was early in the morning, so no one else was up yet. So I said, Norm, come give me a hand. So he helped me get it lined up and bolted it. And I said, so why are you here so early? And he said, well, I lost my job at the post office. And he was really depressed. So I came to see my brother. And I said, well, Norm, you know, maybe you just weren't meant for this world. And he looks at me, and he goes, what do you mean? I said, you know, the higher things, like God. He goes, do you believe in God? I go, yeah. And so, long story short, he started telling me all about the truth. So he spent like the next 3 or 4 hours telling me about the plan of God. And then, I went to my first Bible student meeting in the basement of Jim Sugar, which was living in Clough. And when I went into the meeting, it wasn't with Norm, Norm wasn't there. I went in, and the thing was that everything they were talking about, they were proving from the scriptures. They were sitting around a ping pong table, without the net. Charles Thornton, Barbara Thornton, David Yonvers, before he was married to Sister Suzanne, hadn't been married yet, and Doug and Mary Melville, Norm and Gloria Sendler, three of their kids, and another couple of names gave me. But they hadn't read anything from Scripture. So the point was that when I heard about the ransom and restitution for all, that answered what I had been searching for. There was hope for everybody. Because I always believed that for me, I just was, through no decision of my own, I was born of white parents in America who had a decent living. And I got an education. And I didn't do anything on my own to do that. So what about all these other people in the world who, through no fault of their own, are living over there and suffering? So when I heard about ransom and restitution for all, I was sucked in right there. But I had been searching through esoterical means on how to find, how I could fulfill my spiritual life, but I've been searching for the right thing in all the wrong places. And I had gone through the metaphysical and paranormal groups, and was looking at the spiritualism and so on. I almost enrolled in a school on the coast of Scotland where you could study paranormal events. But I said to myself, I'm searching. And then, when they introduced the high calling, that's what the true discipleship of Jesus meant. And that anyone can do it. And the only thing that can hinder you is you. I said, wow, that's it. So I concentrated right away. Because then that was the other thing that was missing. So Brother Mark answered that question. That was kind of a long way, but that's what I first studied. Ransom, restitution for all, and then the high calling. And those were the three themes that really filled my life and gave me the passion to then study out all the other ramifications of the truth, to understand the whole plan of the ages, to see that the more I studied it, the more ramifications I found, not less. And the more scriptures we read on it, the more they harmonized rather than they didn't. And then when I compared it to the other things I had learned and studied along the way in my short little life, early 20s, it was like they all had problems with the scriptures. So those were all the positives along the way that we studied. And then one of the other things for me was when I studied, we had three meetings a week back then. Three face-to-face meetings a week back then. Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays. But when I studied something and I was reading at home and studying it, I would call one of the brethren in the evening or whatever and just talk to him about it and ask him about it. And then we would just go over it. And I would, you know, I remember going through the chronology with Brother Norm Zendler, trying to figure out certain parts of it. 430 years in Egypt. 430 years in Egypt. You know, Genesis, Exodus 12. So, no, it's not 430 years in Egypt. They sojourned 430 years. They were only in Egypt 250. trying to understand it. But, you know, kept explaining. And it was like, oh, and the light goes on. Now I get it. So, like Brother Russell writes in one place, if you've read a verse 100 times and you don't see the point, read it again. Don't give up. So then, as every controversy came along, or question came along, then we would go home and study that to make it our own, one way or the other, to prove it out. So, in all of that, that's how that unfolded. And then when we got discourses or requests for discourses at conventions, then each one of those became a source of study. So, and each one of those all became, I went about each of those the same way I just elaborated in the first hour. Same approach. Whether it was a subject I was assigned or it was in the scripture. I keep a file that's called potential discourses. Potential discourses. So, my morning coffee, I'm sitting down and I'm thinking on something, or someone said at a meeting, or something we covered in a meeting, or something I had fellowship with, or an email exchange, or just me reading something, and I said, wow, I'd like to check that out. I would write that down, and I'd write down a few clues that I had, and I'd throw it in my potential discourse file. And then at a later date, I flip through. I mean, I've got dozens in there now still. I flip through and I go, you know what? We've just been talking about this. I'm going to ferret this one out more and flush it all out. So, this second hour, this next discourse, which will be shorter than an hour, called Investors, all stemmed from just me somehow was sitting and thinking about we're investors, but we're investors in the Lord's work. And then I started to fill that out. That took several years where I had that concept of being an investor. It took several years to finally just take the time and study it out and put it together. But all the studies, all the, you know, the face-to-face meetings, all the fellowship, going to conventions and everything, all that, all gives you a lot of connecting links on the various aspects of Scripture. And if we hear something that we think sounds different or unusual, we study that out. If I got a question on something, I try to study it out. And so I get the answer instead of just like blowing it off. But I can't always do it. I don't always have the time for that. But I'll do that. Okay. There was a... on these... the Bible aids that we've talked about, I think you know, all that is pretty straightforward. If you do it electronically, I don't do it that way, so I'm not familiar with all the tools. I know eSort and various things, Hadoop database, HTML 1.2 and 3, and all these other great stuff, and I think it's all awesome. The brother in India when I'm there, they're using their smartphones and looking at the reprints from a site a brother has in Georgia. They got all the reprints up. They're on their smartphone and they're just reading it right there. I think that's great. However, long story short is if you can make notes, if you can highlight, if you can underline, then you've got a method of revisiting your subject matter, revisiting some of these places in the volumes and reprints and scriptures where you've already done the homework, as it were, of what's the highlight point. So when I go through the reprints, Brother Doug Melville recommended this years ago, but a lot of us practice it still. When I read a reprint, I put a date at the top. So some of those reprints I go back to, I've read it or referenced it at least like a dozen times. And now I'm looking back at them, and some of them are like 35 years old, and I think, wow, I don't remember this after all those times. I still look back at it. So it's kind of funny. But from memory, some of you, we all got different memory capacities, I understand. For me, to remember scripture, I rarely remember the verse. I hope for the book and the chapter. If I can get to the book and the chapter, I can scan down and pick out the verse. So when I'm reading, or studying, and I see a point that I want to remember, I look up at the top of my page, it says Jeremiah 8. That's what I want to remember. I remember Jeremiah 8. So, even this morning I was jotting down these scriptures. I said to Ruth, I said, okay, I'm looking for this study to show thyself approved. I'm pretty sure that's in Timothy 1 or 2. And she used her phone because I didn't want to take the time to look it up in the concordance. She got it. I said, try the spirits. Where was that again? I think that's in 1 John. And then we got Luke 4:1. And then we got Bereans. I said, I know that's in Acts, but I didn't have a clue on which chapter without looking in the book of Acts. And so she looked it up. So, if I add the verse to me, it might be nice, but I don't remember the verse. I've proved it to myself. I can't memorize all these Bible books, chapters, and verse. So, remember the book and the chapter. Maybe that is useful for you, maybe not. But there it is. Okay. Let's just go into the discourse I was thinking of, called investments. This is a different flavor. And
just one comment.
Yeah.
Well, if you base your studying on discourses alone, then you're not getting the source material. In other words, you're just hearing what that brother brings out of the source material. You're getting, like, a whole other step removed. We want to go to the source material to get the truth.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Very true. We can't let someone help do all our study for us. We can help us, but they can't do it for us. Very good. So investors, and really, you'll see that, where we're going with this, but the basics on being an investor. And I like to start out by saying that I could just say that buy Apple and Amazon stock, and make yourself an investor, and you'll probably make money. No guarantees, though. But nonetheless, I can say that, and you could go home and you could say, hey, that's great. This maintenance guy I know just gave me a couple of good stock names. That would be it. But fortunately, that's not my discourse. But we got to draw on lessons of investors, and I think you're familiar with these. So basic on being an investor is the goal or purpose is to realize a gain or make an increase to the principal investment. So if you got $100 you want to invest, that's your principal. If you invest your $100, you want it to make some money for you. You'd like to make at least 110. All right. That $10 we would call profit. That's the profit you made off your principal investment. $100 invested of your own money, it made you $10. That's your profit. Not all investments are monetary. And so likewise, not all profits are monetary. You and I might invest in an education. We pay money for that education. We go through the education. It didn't make us money just graduating from high school or college or a trade school. That didn't make us any money. But it equips us for a job or a career in which we do get paid good money. So the investment did come back to us in that way. Other times, we take training where we're investing our time in a course for lack of a better word, instruction. And it has nothing to do with about making money. It's about being a better person. So we invest in ourselves to be a better person sometimes by taking different courses. It could be as simple as like that speed reading class that I talked about earlier. The Evelyn ones. Evelyn ones, speed reading. You can invest in that. It might not have anything to do with your career, but you might want to say, I'd like to read more of my material faster because I get bogged up. So there's an example. So the profit there is that you learn how to speak. But you are, and I are principally interested in the concept and practice of investing in people. We're investing particularly in the bride of Christ. Because the work of the gospel age that we've learned is to find a bride for Christ, to be tried, tested, and developed to work with him in the next age, to bless the rest of mankind. That is particularly what we're all about. There, you know the verse from Galatians, the 6th chapter? I'm not giving you the verse. There's the book in the chapter. Do good unto all men, but especially unto the household of faith. So, we're to do good at all, but especially those who have the potential of being of that bride of Christ. That's the focus. And that's what we call the work of the age. There, we know there's a number, 144,000. So we have a goal that we're working toward in just that plain sense. We know we're living at the end of the gospel age, the harvest period. So we know that this is what our returned Lord, the chief reapers, engaged in. So should we. So if we are acting as his reapers to seek the wheat, which represent people, particularly the bride of Christ, then we are actually reapers of people. We are investing to find people. We're investors in people. Now, some scriptures to the point to make this more clear. Turn with me to Matthew 25, please. One of the parables there that we go over. There's a lot of beautiful points to it. It's quite long. We're going to abbreviate it, but it's in Matthew 25, picking up in verse 14. For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them goods, and said unto one, and unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, and to every man according to his several abilities, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received the 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them other 5 talents, or an additional 5 talents. And likewise he that had the 2, he also gained other 2, or he made 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants came and reckoned with them. So, we know that Jesus is that man. He traveled to a far country after this 40 days in earth's atmosphere, after he was resurrected, sent it up into heaven, where he resided. And throughout the gospel age, in 1874, he returned in order to gather his bride to him so they could be united together. That was the work. So when he returned, he's questioning among his servants who they each had different talents, but they all had at least one, what they did with it. And some invested it and made money, but this one didn't. He just buried it in the dirt. He didn't invest it. He just hid it. So we're skipping all the way down through this parable, and we get to verse 24. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew that thou wast a hard man, reaping where thou hadst not sown, and gathering where thou hadst not strawed. And I was afraid, and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, thou wicked and slothful servant, knowest thou that I reap where I sowed not, gather where I had not strawed? Thou oughtest therefore to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received my own with usury. So, long story short, the one with the 1 talent, out of fear, he hid the master's money in the earth. But for our lesson, what we want to observe is Jesus said you should have at least invested it by giving it to those who would pay you interest. on that money. Then you at least would have been making something. So, the Lord is saying He's looking for us as His servants with our various talents, not to bury them in earthly pursuits, but rather to use them in spiritual service, the work of the age, finding the bride of Christ, so that we can at least turn Him a prophet, even if we only have one talent. The prophet He's looking for is spiritual development in us by our activities of investing in His service, but also the completion of the bride is what He's looking for. So, for you and I, talking about the talents, Brother Russell, he gives a list of the talents. He says time, influence, money, tact, and education. So, we add to that availability. And so, what does availability mean? How is that different from time? Well, probably not a lot different. But availability has the thought that we are available for the Lord's service and we make that known to the Lord. So, in order to be available, we have to have a talent of time. You know, we have to have time for our earthly concerns, which are rightfully ours. And if we can sacrifice a little of that, then all the better, because we're demonstrating to the Lord our love and appreciation of the opportunity. Another talent is being a self-starter, for example. Being a self-starter has a lot to do with our personality, but it can be cultivated. In other words, some people, left on their own, they just are the self-starter, and they just kind of feel like they don't have any sense of direction, and they really don't do very well. But if they were assigned a job and they agreed to do it, then they can do the job real well, because now they'll have to take the assignment. But if you have that self-starter talent, not everyone has it, that's not expected of everybody. If you have that, that's a talent indeed, because you could be self-starting in the Lord's service. You don't have to wait for someone to ask. So if you don't have ability, if you don't have that talent of ability being available, and you aren't a self-starter, you really are kind of at a disadvantage. But nonetheless, it's not hopeless, because each of the servants has at least one talent. What that means is you might have to try harder to reach outside your normal way of thinking. Whereas a talent means it kind of comes to you a little more easily. So those who are self-starters and make themselves available, they usually have a lot more opportunities in that service of investing because they have that by nature. But others, but it can be cultivated. Like Brother Russell writes in one of those Mammoth texts, he says, if we don't have the opportunity to witness or serve, but we really want it, pray to the Lord that He might grant it to you. But then we have to watch, right? Watch and pray. So we have to watch those opportunities. I know I used this example, where I gave this discourse at a certain location recently, and I said, you know, someone might decide, well, I'm going to go tracking on Saturday. I'm going to go for 2 hours. We're going to go track this neighborhood. And some of you might remember we used to do that. We used to have quarterly witness activities in this equation. It had to do with our newsletter, where we had to envelope them and put on the addresses and such. We had the bulk mailing. We used to do that. And then we had follow-up names that were in the area, and we'd go out and visit these follow-up names. A couple would go out 2 by 2, and they'd go on the follow-up names. And or then, if the weather was decent, we'd go out tracking in certain different neighborhoods. But, so if I wanted to go tracking on the Saturday, and I made the announcement, I'm going to be tracking on Saturday, starting at 11 o'clock. We're going to be here. We're going to meet at this Tim Hortons at 20, because they're working Tim Hortons back. Dunkin' Donuts. And 11. Now, everyone who hears it can say, am I going to make myself available? And do I have the help to be able to go do that? And, you know, they'll weigh it all out. But they had to have a certain, you know, self-startedness to say, well, I am going to go do that. So with all of that being said, that's just a simple example. It still comes down to us individually what we're going to do to invest our time. So in today's world, we're finding that with the advent of social media, there's many ways to witness if you want to take the time to take advantage of the internet. There's all sorts of means of communicating with people and contacts and to share a little bit, one way or the other. Sometimes it's just very, 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 very simple. Day before yesterday, I just took the time to send a text on some spiritual thoughts to an individual I thought could use it, and we exchanged about 3 texts in my workday. And later on, it came at the right time. So, simple. You know, if they're busy, they don't have to read a text, but it's there for later. That's all. They don't even have to reciprocate. But there's all sorts of kind of things that can be done. With social media that we, you know, before you used to have to write a letter, kind of laborious, then they'd have to wait to get it. Or a telephone call, which is still good, but a telephone call, someone's got to answer it. Might not be convenient. Still good, but nonetheless, you know, there's these other methods which are a lot less intrusive. Okay, we'll leave it at that. But my main point of visiting this verse is to see that the Lord expects us to view His work as if we're investors. He was looking for a return on the talents that He gave to each of His servants. Now, an investor's mindset. Investors expect to experience both losses and gains. Rarely is it ever all gain. If you've done any kind of investing over a period of time, you know that there's going to be some losses to experience. It would be nice if it was all gains, but it's like never all gains. So, another aspect, I'll come back to that, another aspect is that if we're privileged to be His servant, have this responsibility to serve Him, then it becomes the work of harvesting, because that's His work upon His return. So, what do we expect? Do we expect that every witness opportunity is going to be a gain? Or do we expect that sometimes there's going to be losses? Well, the majority, actually, they don't develop the way we would like and hope. But that's okay, because that loss of that person responding is not reflective of how he benefits from that investment. There's other areas or aspects of that investment that still becomes a profit to us personally. Investors have to be patient. Time's an important element of investing. For example, compounding interest, dividends, an increase in certain investment vehicles over time. So, like if you buy a stock, you bought Apple back when they first initiated that stock offering, if you had just invested $1,000, you wouldn't be sitting here. You might be sitting here, but you'd have a lot nicer car. You'd have made a lot of money. But that was a risk, high risk. But nonetheless, it took time in order for that investment to increase. That's the point. So there's time element and patience that have to be there. In fact, even with the CD, certificate of deposit. Very safe. Not 100% safe, but very safe. The point is that if you withdraw it early because you become impatient, for whatever reason, there's a penalty attached. You don't get the interest. You get your principal back, but there's some penalty associated with it. So you have to wait to the end. So if you want to wait 5 years, you get a 5-year CD. But if you need the money in 3, there's a penalty. So again, the emphasis is we have to be patient. So too with our harvest work investment. We have to be patient and recognize that some of our investment is long term. We don't see an immediate response. That's huge. Another investor's mindset is greater risk usually yields a greater return. That is, it produces a larger profit. So if there's more risk involved in a financial investment, usually there's a greater return. Let's use a simple example. Junk bonds. If you invest in junk bonds, a junk bond means it's very risky. However, they have to offer you a higher percentage on your investment to get people to take that risk. In other words, if it was super safe and high and paying a very high yield, everyone because they'd have enough people that would come at a lower rate. Long story short, greater risk, possibility of greater yield, or greater loss. It can mean a greater loss. So you don't want to put all your eggs in that basket, in other words. But that leads us to the next element of an investor's mindset, and that is tolerance for risk. Tolerance for risk. A very important aspect of investing. And that has to do with each of our own personality and characters and our various responsibilities. So, tolerance for risk is what a financial advisor will try to find out when they interview you, if you want to use them as your advisor. What is your risk tolerance? So what they mean by that is that if I invest you in certain stocks, for example, are you going to lay awake at night when you see the stocks drop and lose sleep so the next day you're irritated, agitated, and you go to work and your boss doesn't like you? That's bad. We can't have that. So we need to invest you in things that aren't so scary to you. They have lower risk. Even though they're not going to pay as good of a yield, you'll have peace of mind. You can sleep at night, you get up in the morning refreshed, you're happy, you go to work, your boss likes you. So that is a better way to go. So then they try to weigh out, okay, can you take 20% of your investment and put it in risk and 80% in safe? Would that be all right? And you go, okay. And you try. So, long story short is we each have our own risk tolerance. Now, in the Lord's Word, risk tolerance is there too. Some of us don't, we have a high tolerance for risk. That means we can spend a lot of time in the Lord's service. We don't mind putting a lot of money in the Lord's service. We don't mind giving up, making money, or whatever it may be, because we have that high tolerance for risk. If we don't have a lot of results, we're still okay because we felt good about the investment. But if we that doesn't make us feel comfortable, okay, don't invest so much, but still be an investor. Still do something in there. So that you don't you have. You know, you don't want it to be all in and then not or none. If you can split it so that you got a risk tolerance, that's good. Now, of course, we're all fully consecrated, but we all have earthly responsibilities, and that's all understood. The Lord understands that. So with these talents, the main thing was is to be invested. Now, successful investing requires research, reflection, an overall plan or strategy, a proper accounting of one's ability to invest, where to invest, and how much. Now, does that sound overwhelming? Well, it can be. And a lot of people that just don't invest financially. They just don't do it because they don't put the time in it. It just seems overwhelming. Where do I start? And so they never get off. They never get past start. So, long story short, in the Lord's work, successful investing, again, requires its research and reflecting. Now, I'll give a simple example. In the Ecclesia business meetings, what do? We take the information our secretary tells us. We take the information our treasurer tells us. We take the information our IT brother tells us. We take the information that our librarian tells us. We take the information that the witness activity coordinator tells us. And we take all that information, and the overseas coordinator. We take all that information, and we're using that to plan our strategy for the next quarterly business report, next year sometime, 6 months. And so, as a group, we're doing that at the ecclesia level. That, we're coming up, we're planning, we've researched it, and we're coming up with a strategy. Now, all we're saying is, on a personal level, in our own lives, we should be doing the same kind of thing. So that we're not just reacting when something happens. We actually want to have a plan. So that we try to make ourselves available to be investing in the Lord's service. We want that our whole life is part of this overall plan of being the Lord's servant. And so it affects every aspect of our lives. Group investors, you could talk about that like a pool of investors. A super easy way of demonstrating that is mutual funds. Mutual funds, there's different kinds you can buy. Let's take a Vanguard index fund. And so Vanguard, for a certain fee, allows you to invest invest your $100 in that index fund, and then they have a fund manager, and he invests that in the index, but you and 1,000 other people all have invested. And it'll go up or down depending as the index funds and investing goes up or down. So in that sense, we're a mutual fund. It's mutual because there's more than one. It's not like buying a single stock, like half the stock. You're a mutual investor. With that, we have an ecclesia. So we were just talking about we are like a mutual fund investor. We're a group investment. And so from that aspect, each one of us can participate in investing, at least at that level, by attending the business meetings and contemplating what's going on. And even if we don't have anything to say on it, we listen to what's being presented, we say, oh, that sounds like a good plan, that sounds reasonable, and then we call for a vote, not different motion. Then we just raise our hand. When we do so, to that extent, we're investing. And then if we contribute to the class at all, well, then we know our funds are being partly used for that. If we get a donation from outside, it becomes our responsibility as an ecclesia to decide. It wasn't our money. Someone else is saying, I want to be a mutual investor with those brothers in Oakland County. And so they send us a check. They say, we'd like it used for this, for that, or use it at your own discretion for the witness work. And so then, here we are. We're the mutual fund managers for Oakland County. That's how we're gauging our investment. I like this. Remember in Matthew 14, 25-35, for time's sake, we won't read that, but Matthew 14, 25-35. This is cited so often, you'll know it. Jesus had been feeding the multitude. They'd been traveling with him. He was giving them food. They didn't even have to go back to their homes. There were a lot of them. And he turned to them and he said, if you want to be my disciple, you've got to love everyone less than you love me. You've got to hate your father, your mother, your sister, your wife, and even your own life. You mean you got to love them less than you love them. And then you got to bear your cross and follow me. So the crowd was astonished. Here he was, he had invested in feeding this crowd miraculously. He was hearing their diseases, he was healing their sick, which cost him personally of his own vitality, his own life. So, his life principle, he was pouring out. So it cost him to do this, and now, suddenly, he has this whole group with him, and he's turning around and he wants to spin him out. Because he knows he's looking for the bride, because he knows that's the Heavenly Father's plan, and he's conforming to it. So he knows that the way to be of the bride is the way to sacrifice. So, even though he had invested personally heavily in a multitude, relatively few had actually become his disciples. So few that when he ascended, they said there was basically about 500 that believed on him, roughly. So that was, but it didn't slow Jesus' action. He knew that in the long run, the bride would be found, even though it would take almost 2,000. But he started out as an example of the chief investors in, to him, of the Heavenly Father's work. So, he actually, when he presented that thought of discipleship to the multitude, remember he used two parables. There was the one who was going to build the tower, how he should sit down first and count the cost to see if he had enough money to finish the building of it. Because if he started and ran out of money, he'd just be a laughing stock. The partially built tower would just be his folly. And the second one was a man going to war. He better figure out, better sit down and count the cost to see if he can finish the battle before he begins it. So that's where we get that phrase, counting the cost, when we talk to people about consecration. Counting the cost. So because Jesus said counting the cost, instead of saying it's now or never, you got to be my disciple or you're going to roast in hell. Right there we have a present truth concept that Jesus intimated, that there is a future probation rather than this life ends it all. Because if this life ended it all, why would he say count the cost? He would have said either follow me now or burn in hell. But because he knew the future restitution, he knew that the call now is only for those willing to embark in a narrow way. That's the present truth concept. He said you got to count the cost. But But notice that two things. He invested in a big group knowing he's only going to get a few. And the other thing was they were all strangers to him. Of his own family, such as his brothers and sisters, how he believes. So when you and I invest in the harvest work, it's mostly strangers. We're investing in people we don't even know. We may never know. And in fact, we may water from one or plant a seed from one end, and someone else, other brother or sister somewhere else in the country or the world, they may be the ones to water them further. And we might never know if that's the case. But nonetheless, as investors in the Lord's work, that's one of the things we look to. Here's some examples. You and I invest, as an ecclesia, we've invested in the internet. We invest in prayer booths, mailers, booklets, tracts, ads, TV ads, radio, social media, public meetings, and follow-up meetings. And we invested in all of that, not knowing any of the people, unless maybe occasionally we invited a friend or a family or a co-worker. But the vast majority, we never knew any of them, and we're investing in them. But that's the Lord's way. We're following Jesus' example when we do that. That's known as risk-taking inventions. We don't know what kind of return we might get. But Jesus didn't water down the message. He knew it was only going to be a few to respond. He had in mind 144,000. And you remember that any church you ever attend, the only other ones that have 144,000 are Jehovah's Witnesses. The Methodists don't have 144,000. Presbyterians don't. The Baptists don't. The Catholics don't. Why? Because then who wants to hear that? There's only going to be 144,000 that succeed. Well, they're not going to come to the churches. It's going to really drive down your attendance. It's going to make everyone feel guilty. And no one was going to want to attend. So there's no one to then support the whole church arrangement. But with us, we're saying, count the cost. Because there's future opportunity if this doesn't interest you now. Because this is free will. So you have to have a choice if you want to do this. So we don't water down our message. Now, let's go on a little bit further. Peter and John, they witnessed after Pentecost in the temple, or temple precincts. And they eventually got arrested, spent the night, and were beaten. And yet, they went right back out, and they started investing themselves again in the ministry. Even under the threat of pain, I guess. But they did. So they were extreme risk takers. They were willing to literally risk it all in their investments. And they've been, obviously, an excellent example of that. Extreme risk takers. And then there's an aspect in which later, when Peter was the witness of the Gentiles, God wanted to send him to Cornelius and his family. When AD 36, the time of the Gentiles coming, Peter had the two keys, the Jewish Christians first and then the Gentile Christians. But Peter didn't want to go because he said, Lord, I've never gone and have broken the law in this way to meet with Gentiles and such. And God sent down, remember, the vision with the blanket with the unclean animals and the voice from heaven saying, eat. And Peter protested, but finally the Lord prevailed. So Peter acquiesced. So Peter went. Can you imagine what it must have been like when he was standing at the doorstep of Cornelius, a Roman centurion, not just some Gentile, but a Roman centurion. He's just thinking back, you know, there was a centurion at Jesus' death and the cross. He's just thinking all this, and he's a poor fisherman, and even though he's enlightened with the Holy Spirit and such, still he is. He's got this flesh to work through. Yet he did it. And I imagine when the servant opened the door, it wasn't Cornelius himself, and invited him in and encouraged him. Peter was just undoubtedly just dumbfounded with seeing how the Lord worked in this way. But that was extreme risk-taking for Peter. God told him to do it, but he was really outside of his normal environment. So you and I, too, as in investors, we can find certain risk-taking involved in just going outside what our comfort zone, to use that phrase. That we might be asked to go, some of us might go to different countries, different cultures. We might travel in places that, you know, the possibility of becoming ill or injured or whatever it may be. Or other of us, our comfort zone, that would be okay. Maybe that's not so tough, but for other of us, we might go outside our comfort zone just by walking up and talking to people that we don't know. Because talking to people we don't know makes us very uncomfortable. In fact, they say public speaking is number one fear, right? So, reaching out to other people to be a witness, strangers, that's like really bold. And for some of us, that's really a challenge, right there. Just that simple. Or even putting out a tract. That can be outside our comfort zone. For most of us, if not all of us, standing at the state fair is outside our comfort zone. Because none of us are doing it in our spare time with other things. I know this. I don't go for carrying maintenance and have a food because I'm not. However, each one of us outside our comfort zone. So be encouraged, because I look around the table and I know all of you are outside your comfort zone at some level in your witnessing, and that's a good testimony. So we should encourage each other in that. It's scriptural. Then with the Apostle Paul, I mean, really, what can we say? He went outside his comfort zone like all the time. In 2 Corinthians 6, 3 through 10, remember, he listed like over a dozen things that he suffered. Shipwreck, beatings, drowning, famine, heat, cold, being challenged by false brethren, watching for all the churches. So he went through all of this for what? For the Lord's cause, for the Lord's people, and finding that bride and trying to encourage them. So he was an extreme risk taker, fully invested. Brother Russell, what a risk taker, right? He invested his fortune. He started the chain store. Not most of us think of that, but he started the chain store with men's clothing. And he was the purchasing agent for his father's business when he was like 15 or 16. And he even drew up the articles of agreement between him and his father. But yet, here he was willing to invest all in the Lord's service in that way. And yet, he received a lot of criticism, as you and I both know. So we won't dwell on that, but we'll say here's a relatively modern-day example of extreme risk-taking. Yet, even though we might not see hardly any results for our investment in others, there's always a profit on what it does to us. So part of finding the bride of Christ and the developing the bride of Christ is developing a Christ-like character. So if we see that this is what Jesus did, know ye not that I must be about my Father's business, so too we want to imitate that. And as we imitate what he did, it helps develop a Christ-like character in ourselves because we are willing to invest in other people. Now, one of the major hindrances outside of seeing a profit of people coming into the truth, let's say, one of the major hindrances, I think, is the sense of rejection. The sense of rejection has a certain amount of a sense of failure associated. I'm not accepted by somebody, I'm rejected. Because in some way I fail to meet their expectations. So I'm going to interpret this one of a multitude of ways. We're all different. But we might interpret it as if, well, they aren't worthy of me, or they aren't worthy of my efforts, or I really must be a failure, and I'm just not going to, you know, put myself through that again, and, you know, the list goes on and on and on. And a lot of it just gets inbred in us by different experiences growing up. Sometimes we can inherit some of the genes that lean that way. Other times we can be browbeaten by parents or other mentors in our life that make us feel inferior. We never do enough. We never can get it right. We're always being corrected. We never hear a word of praise. So we have this experience of rejection all growing up as kids, and so we feel as if we're unacceptable. I must be unacceptable. They can't all be wrong. But you know, the long and short of it is, when we translate that subconsciously in our witnessing, it becomes very painful to feel this kind of rejection. So then it kind of limits how we want to invest. So I suggest that it's easier to invest in a group when we don't feel a personal rejection on ourselves. However, like standing at the fair or passing out tracts or giving a word of truth to somebody, we are really taking a risk when we invest in doing that because it's a personal investment. And we're going to have a certain personal reaction. And that's where, even if we do receive the rejection, because of the higher risk, the Father knows it. And Jesus knows how much risk you and I are taking to do that. And when we experience a rejection, or a being turned down, or turned away, yeah, we just give glory to God, that we can suffer that a little bit, even though it doesn't seem like much, but it's very painful to us. Mentally and emotionally, they appreciate it. And if we continue to press on with that over time, then we develop that Christ-like character because of what did it say about him? He was rejected of men. His own received him not. It was prophesied in Isaiah 53 that that's the very case. Yet he continued to do that which was right. So, whether we ever bring anyone into the truth, yet if we continue to be investors at some level, we benefit. We benefit in our own character. Now, I'm going to skip through some of these different times. I'm going to throw this one out there because I got two of them from you. I really like them. One is that when Jeff Hausman and I were co-partnering, and we both quit our jobs. He was from Ohio, and I was from around here. And I remember I put my pickup truck up on blocks in the backyard of Lisa Fowler, where I had been renting the basement suite, and put my stuff in boxes to go co-partnering with my job, and went down to Texas co-partnering, and then Jeff and I met in Texas, and then we went over to New Mexico, Albuquerque, New Mexico. We were staying with a little slightly older couple there. And we go out for 8 hours a day, going door to door, promoting the magazine first volume. And if no one answered or they answered, didn't want to buy it for a buck, we left the track with them or left the track on the door. We did 8 hours a day. But I didn't do it that long. But Ruth did it for several years prior to that. She went out with a couple of sisters she knew, mainly Joy Thompson, and they did that. So she knew that you didn't have any money when you were co-partnering. So she heard that Jeff and I were co-partnering. We were down at the Ann and Joe Rustafo's. And she mailed us each $50 with a note in there that when I co-partnered, I knew I didn't have much money. Hopefully this helps. Because she was investing in a couple of investors. And so when I got that, I was like, wow, that's awesome. Here's someone who's thinking about us doing this. And neither Jeff nor I were raising the truth. And I'd only been in the truth about a year by that time. And it was like, wow. I hadn't even read all six volumes yet. And I'm going door to door. And, which I'm not recommending. I said to myself, I want to meet this sister sometime. Because she was living in Chicago back then. And so, that was what initiated my interest in knowing Ruth. Because I felt she was a fellow investor that had a similar mindset. And so when we talked and we fell in love and our consecrations were compatible, then I say she invested $50 and put her money where her mouth was, and then you'll have to ask her if she thinks she made a good investment. that's one of my favorite investors, Storm. But I got another one, and it's here. And that is that you all, well, most of you, if not all of you, remember Brother Bob. And how the Reverend here invested in him, in his activities in India. And how he started, he went door to door as well. And, but it developed into large public meetings. And he had an excellent way of presenting the truth. And yet then he fell away later. He changed. She kind of adopted a little bit of a clergy attitude. He was the pastor, and he stopped the elections of elders and deacons in the various ecclesias that he had influence over. And he was sending them their Sunday lessons to over a dozen different ecclesias around India. And about literally 10,000 of people had heard the truth in the public meetings. So we had to stop investing in him, in that work, and which we did to, we were sorry for it. Very sorry for it. But, I mean, I went over there and we talked about differences. And however, time goes by, and what we find out is that Sister Nithya Martin, Brother Godwin's mother, and then father, what's your father's first name?
Martin.
What's the last name?
Roch.
Which is that from King, right?
Yep.
Yeah,
it means King.
Okay. They went to a public meeting, I believe, that Brother Rama had. They had learned the truth. They had not, in contact with Brother Rama for a number of years, but then when he changed, they could start seeing some of his changes, and then they left him, and then they met with the other brother who had left Brother Rama's group as well when he made his changes. So here we are, all these years later, and we have Brother Godwin meeting with us. Now, never in our wildest dreams would I have imagined that the original investments in Brother Varma in the early 1990s would have resulted in us having an Indian brother meeting with us here in our own inclusion. Especially, I didn't think of it after Brother Varma had deviated from these aspects of truth that was in, like 95. That here we are in 2018, and there still would be a, what's the word? The concept is that investment over 20 years ago would have resulted in someone meeting in our equation here. When we had stopped that investment, what?
Dividend,
that's good. Residual, I think, was the word I was going for. Okay. That he actually now is meeting with us from that original investment. So we go back to risk-taking, being patient, just being active, a group investors, let alone an individual investor, in order to try to accomplish the Lord's will. That's it. Did you give this before the speaker?
I still didn't hear what
you said. I don't think she gave it publicly.
Well, if you were so interested in meeting her that you don't remember when you met her.
I remember when I met her after I told Porter it was at the Columbus, Ohio convention. What I don't remember is the first convention I went to in Jackson when I met my probably 85 brother now. And we hadn't ever talked even up to that point. So all 85 brothers were new. I can tell you Jim Parkinson spoke, I remember that.
That's a good memory. I can't remember where I was. 30 years ago.
Well, brother, thank you for your patience and giving us both hours. Trust about your closing.